next met with Dr. Mark Pegram, and as a follow-up to the conversation with Dr. Perez, I asked for his thoughts on the Cleopatra study of pertuzumab.
I was pleasantly surprised by the magnitude of the treatment effect. I mean, the hazard ratio was about 0.6, high statistical significance. This was a planned interim analysis, the first interim analysis. So the number of events for the overall survival analysis was not very many, which is arguably a good thing. But nevertheless, the p-value for the overall survival benefit by the addition of pertuzumab was something like 0.005. It didn't hit the O'Brien-Fleming value of 0.001. But nevertheless, it'll be interesting to follow that over time because it sure looks like it's well poised to result in a survival benefit. Now, I'm surprised by this a little bit because, remember, pertuzumab had kind of a storied history back in the day. Originally, it was thought that maybe it would have efficacy in disease states that don't have HER2 amplification or overexpression. Because it can block HER2, HER3 heterodimers, which are a potent signaling force, it was thought that maybe even in HER2-negative diseases like prostate cancer, non-small cell lung cancer, ovarian cancer, breast cancer, that are HER2-negative, they thought maybe this pertuzumab antibody would have efficacy. Well, in phase 1 and 2 trials, it really didn't. So that's why it had kind of a dark horse, you know, late comer view from many oncologists, including a lot of clinical investigators. So this is really a wonderful surprise. And the magnitude of the improvement in time to progression was something like 6 months. So for a metastatic cohort, this is an impressive result and arguably will be practice changing.
So one other part of the data that was kind of interesting, I guess because of the timing of when they recruited people, I guess in 2005, 2008, something like that.
Right.
Very few of these people had had prior adjuvant trastuzumab.
Correct.
What do you think that means, if anything?
We just don't know. I mean, this has been a problem with many of the trials now, even the trials of trastuzumab. The original pivotal trials, remember, all those trials were done in a trastuzumab adjuvant naive population. And whether we can translate those results to the modern era still is completely unknown. So clearly we need more study and more focus on this cohort of patients that we're seeing now in the modern era who are survivors of adjuvant trastuzumab but nevertheless relapse. They probably do have a different natural history, but it's still largely unknown. And whether or not pertuzumab will have similar benefit in trastuzumab-exposed patients, we just don't know.
Have you seen patients since San Antonio where you thought to yourself, if pertuzumab was available, I would use it?
Of course.
What kind of situations?
First-line metastatic breast cancer, HER2 positive.
It's hard to, I mean, the toxicity certainly doesn't seem like much.
You know what? That is one of the most impressive things about pertuzumab is it really didn't result in much change in toxicity at all. I think there was a little bit increase in neutropenia, mucositis, and some lower GI stuff, but I think that largely might be due to the fact that they stay on chemo longer because they have such an improvement in time to progression.
So that'll be interesting. I guess, you know, people are bringing up the issues of cost, which, of course, we don't really know about specifically. But,
right.
You know, I guess that's going to be an issue. But it is hard to ignore those data. Where are things heading? And, you know, obviously the thought would be adding in pertuzumab in the adjuvant setting. I've heard about the so-called affinity trial.
Correct.
What's going on?
Yeah, it's already running.
Who's doing it?
It's a European-based study, but there are North American sites.
And what's the design?
It's same chemo, trastuzumab, plus or minus pertuzumab, same as Cleopatra, but in early stage disease, all HER2 positive.
Anything new in terms of the immunoconjugate TDM1 in breast cancer?
Well, I mean, the results from ongoing pivotal trials are anxiously and eagerly awaited. The data presented previously in a randomized phase 2 trial comparing TDM1 versus chemo, trastuzumab certainly looked very promising and encouraging. The remarkable thing about TDM1, which, as you know, is a maytansin antibody-drug conjugate, where the cytotoxic species is a maytansin derivative coupled to a strong chemical linker that then binds to lysine residues on the trastuzumab antibody backbone. This antibody is internalized, and in the low pH and hostile environment of the endosome, the maytansin is released and causes cytotoxicity specifically for cells that have internalized the antibody-drug conjugate. So the remarkable thing, though, about TDM1 is its lack of toxicity. You know, compared to chemo and trastuzumab, there's no nausea, no alopecia, no neutropenia, no vomiting. It's really, truly remarkable.
And have you used T-DM1 yourself?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we've participated in a number of the T-DM1 trials at University of Miami. I've had a patient who got around about 30 cycles of T-DM1 in the metastatic setting, refractory to prior trastuzumab and lapatinib. She had a fantastic response, which was durable for a very long time, still in remission at this point.
Oncologists are hearing an awful lot about another immunoconjugate, brentuximab vedotin, Hodgkin lymphoma and anaplastic large cell lymphoma.
Yes.
There, if I saw that correctly, it looked like the big data came out a year ago in December.
Mm-hmm.
It got approved in August.
Yes.
And when you hear about it, it kind of doesn't sound that much different than T-DM1.
Correct. I mean, the concept is the same. It's an antibody-drug conjugate.
But I mean, even the efficacy doesn't seem, I mean, I don't know, some unmet need. I guess there are two more things I want to ask you about HER2. One is you had a paper you were part of in Breast Cancer Research and Treatment that was published last year looking at a common source of questions from oncologists, discordance between the primary and the paired met. In this case, you were looking at HER2.
Exactly.
And it was like sort of a meta-analysis.
Absolutely.
You went through the whole thing.
Right.
Can you just sort of capsulize in general that whole issue of discordance, but not just HER2, but also ER testing?
Absolutely. So this is a collaboration I had with Nemat Hosami from Sydney, and she pulled together all of the published data on this issue of discordance with HER2 testing from the published literature. So it's a publication-level meta-analysis. And she excluded any studies where the testing was done by a different method or in a different laboratory or at different times. So these are all the studies that use the same assay to test the primary and the metastasis done at the same time by the same assay methodology, whether it be IHC or FISH, all done at the same time in the same lab. So the N was around about 2,500, if I can recall, but you can look at the abstract in front of you and remind me. So it's a big study. Now, what the null hypothesis was that there should be no difference between primaries and metastasis with regard to HER2 status if it's a stable biological entity and doesn't change over time. But in fact, we did observe discordance. And in fact, the discordance rate between primaries and distant metastasis was more than the discordance rate between primary and nodal metastasis, suggesting that there might be a different biology in terms of HER2 for distant metastasis compared to regional metastasis. And what's even more interesting is that there was a strong trend towards discordance in the form of HER2 negative converting to HER2 positive in the distant metastasis than the other way around. And if this was just a random artifact, you would have expected that the HER2 positive switching to negative rate would be equal to the HER2 negative switching to HER2 positive rate, and it was not. So that's very provocative. And it suggests that there may be some cases where the HER2 amplicon is acquired during the evolution of a primary breast cancer when it's evolving onto metastasis.
So has that made you more aggressive about biopsying people?
Absolutely. That plus data presented at ASCO last year looking at steroid receptor discordance. Absolutely. I think it's really essential this day and age. Now, especially with the safety of biopsy techniques, you know, at our center, our interventional radiologists pride themselves on being able to get tissue from anywhere, anytime, almost always safely. So really, this puts the burden on us as clinicians to understand what the pathophysiology of the disease is at the time that you're treating it. And it really does strongly suggest that we need to consider biopsying first diagnosis of metastatic disease.
What about a patient who's had a biopsy at first diagnosis, who's now received multiple lines of therapy, maybe a couple of years down the line? Do you ever consider re-biopsying metastatic disease?
Absolutely, especially in as much as it might inform participation in phase one studies. Because if you discover by whatever methodology available at your center or by central laboratory testing, and now there are some very interesting diagnostic assays out there available in oncology, including expression arrays and sequencing campaigns that are commercially available. They're out there. I get reports in my clinic now from these types of studies. And so some of those are actionable, potentially. You know, if you find that there's probably upregulation of signaling along the mTOR pathway in a patient with refractory disease, well, then you might consider putting them on an mTOR inhibitor, for example. Hmm. A good example of that was Joyce O'Shaughnessy's presentation at San Antonio this December, where they sequenced a small number of triple-negative breast cancers, but based on the whole genome sequence data, they found a couple of cases that had potentially actionable items. One was like a BRAF mutation, one had activation of mTOR. What was remarkable is those patients then went on specific inhibitors on early phase trials, and some of them had responses. I know this is just anecdotal, But it's very exciting because it opens up potential for, you know, our ability to exploit these data sets in the future.
Yeah, actually, Joyce presented a couple of those cases at a symposium we did a couple months ago. But would you put this in the category of don't do this at home, kids? In other words, this should really, you don't want somebody out there getting some commercial test and then use an off-label mTOR inhibitor?
You're exactly right. Right now, these should probably be done at centers that have sequencing campaigns that are already ongoing, they're already funded as a research tool, and they have a portfolio of early phase trials, phase one or phase two trials, that have actionable interventions against targets that might come to light in a sequencing campaign. So I absolutely agree. This is not ready for prime time, but it certainly points a direction, and I believe this is a strong signal pointing us in this direction that we need to start thinking about this and generating these large data sets and being more thoughtful and having more insight into the molecular pathogenesis of metastatic disease by rebiopsying.
You know, it's great to stoke the enthusiasm in this kind of translational work, but I think it's important to be practical too. So one question about HER2 and TKIs. We've heard in the past about neratinib. Now there's another agent, afatinib. What do we know about these agents and where are they heading?
Well, there was data presented at San Antonio on neratinib. It was a pivotal trial comparing neratinib versus capecitabine and lapatinib. The trial was negative, and I think your listeners can review that data and wait for the peer review before making further judgments. I don't want to say too much more about it because I was on the Data Safety Monitoring Committee for that trial.
And it's a pretty toxic drug.
Sure. Neratinib has significant challenges with diarrhea. There's no question about that.
What about afatinib? We've heard a lot about it from the lung cancer groups. What about it in breast cancer?
I mean, it's another pan-ERBB inhibitor. I think it's going to arguably have similar efficacy signals like we're used to seeing with lapatinib and neratinib. And as long as it can pass safety signals, then I would anticipate that it would have potential for efficacy just like these other HER2-targeting TKIs have.
I was curious, rarely see any DCIS presentations that interest me as a medical oncologist, but there was one at San Antonio, which is, I don't know, I hadn't remembered seeing anything like it before, looking at a genomic analysis. Mm-hmm. This was some variation out of Oncotype.
Yep.
Can you talk about that paper and what you think it meant?
Well, you know, it's very interesting, and this is an age-old story. I mean, remember that DCIS is very common. There's something like 45,000 cases a year, and there's no question that many of those patients, if not most, are overtreated because most patients, even in the historical era where DCIS was treated with lumpectomy alone, even without radiation, most of those patients, the majority, never relapsed at all, just with surgery alone. And so Mel Silverstein, as you remember back in the day, with his Van Nuys cohort, hypothesized that there must be a group of DCISs that don't need anything other than surgical excision, if that, and that they'll do perfectly fine without any radiation. And I think that this Oncotype story from the ECOG database supports that hypothesis. Now, it was a relatively, you know, modest-sized study, but these cohorts are very hard to come by. This was a non-radiation-treated cohort, a very unique cohort indeed. Mostly older patients, quite an advanced age. Almost all of them were low-grade, okay, very few high grades in that study. So it was a very unique cohort. Almost all of them were strongly ER-positive, for example. But in this cohort, applying a variation of the Oncotype assay, which involved just 7 cancer-related genes and 5 housekeeping controls. And most of those genes were in the proliferation group, and then one was in the steroid group. Progesterone receptor was in there. So using that panel of just 7 transcripts, they were able to break out prognosis of DCIS into intermediate, high, and low-risk strata, similar to the Oncotype that we're familiar with in the adjuvant setting. And in the low-risk strata, the risk of any ipsilateral breast tumor occurrence event was down around 10%, and the risk of invasive recurrence was about 5% in the lowest risk cohort. But these are patients that did not have any radiation, recall, okay? In the high risk, it was more like 25% risk of relapse and probably double the frequency of invasive relapse, around 10% as I recall. So this suggests the possibility that you could do a trial of low risk DCIS recurrence score patients and randomize them to lumpectomy alone versus lumpectomy plus radiation, and maybe prove that this low-risk group doesn't need radiation. And that would be huge. It would be as impactful as the original Oncotype chemo story, in my view. And I believe this kind of investigation needs to be done. The other thing I'd like to see is I'd like to see this DCIS variant of the Oncotype assay applied to a modern DCIS cohort that actually did get radiation. That would also be interesting just to see if it holds prognostic significance in a modern cohort.
So like TAILORx and RxPONDER,
yeah,
but for DCIS.
Exactly.
We're not relating to chemo, but again, a prospective.
To radiation. Correct.
But again, takes a long time until we have results from a trial like that. I mean, based on what you've seen, I don't even know if this assay is available. Can you order it?
I don't know the answer to that, but I probably wouldn't yet.
Remember,
the ECOG study was around 600 patients in the cohort overall, 650, I believe, thereabouts, and only about half of them were subject to the RT-PCR assay Oncotype DCIS variation in this analysis. So I would consider this really, you know, pilot preliminary data, but it certainly strongly points towards support of Mel Silverstein's original hypothesis that we're over-treating the vast majority of DCISs.
Yeah, I kind of been hearing, too, that it's more like moving DCIS into the genomic era, out of the surgeon's era, and those kind of arguments, which is, but maybe needs a little bit more data.
Yes.
So, yeah, I was just telling you as you came in today, we got this press release hot off, I mean, it literally just got published. I don't know anything about it, but, you know, I was thinking about the trastuzumab beyond progression story.
Right.
We were arguing about that for years, and
yes,
then finally we saw data on it.
Yes.
We've been hearing the same thing in terms of bevacizumab, and now there's a colon study, which we had heard about last week at ASCO GI. It was close to reporting. It's like 800 patients. It's a big study.
Yep.
Of continuation of bevacizumab on progression of colorectal cancer, and supposedly there's a survival benefit. And I'm going to sort of bring that back towards breast cancer, but A, are you surprised to hear about it? Do you think that colorectal cancer is fundamentally different than, say, breast cancer?
I'm actually not surprised to hear this, and I'm actually delighted that the group went forward and did a large study to interrogate this issue. I think it's very important. Clearly, from the literature, there's been this observation in experimental models of a rebound following withdrawal from VEGF or VEGF receptor-targeted agents. And it suggests that as soon as you stop the perturbation of that axis, then the tumors go right back to where they were before, if not worse, okay? And so if that hypothesis is correct, it would suggest that long-term suppression of that axis would be important. And I think that's exactly what the colorectal trial suggests, exactly. And it suggests that there might be opportunity for this, dare I say, in breast cancer again. I mean, there is now a question whether or not longer-term administration of the drug would have resulted, for example, in a survival advantage in ECOG 2100, let's say.
Yeah,
remember,
yeah,
the disappointment with that trial that everyone talks about is there was no survival benefit. Well, they didn't give bevacizumab for life in that trial. Had they, this begs the question, might they have seen the signal? You know, there was also data at San Antonio on the combination of trastuzumab and bevacizumab, the Averil study presented by Luca Gianni. And, you know, that trial had also some suggestion of efficacy. I mean, it met its statistical endpoint in the independent review that was done in a blinded fashion, even though the investigator reported results on time to progression had a p-value of something like 0.07. But nevertheless, it suggests, even in the HER2-positive space, that there might be some potential of efficacy for perturbation of VEGF. The magnitude of the benefit wasn't very impressive. It was something like a three-month change in PFS, and there was no survival impact, obviously. But it's a small study, and it suggests that there might be some potential for efficacy even in the HER2 subset. And this colon study kind of opens the door for dusting off bevacizumab again in an investigational fashion in metastatic breast cancer.
So, let me go back to trastuzumab, bevacizumab, because that's obviously been a big interest of yours. Were you disappointed to see the Averil results, and what do you think it means in terms of the Beth adjuvant trial?
I think, you know, disappointed in terms of the magnitude of the efficacy signal, yes. Disappointed in terms of proof of concept, no, because it actually did support the original hypothesis that perturbation of VEGF might result in a measurable treatment effect in HER2-positive disease, and the study actually did demonstrate that. What bothers me about the NSABP adjuvant trastuzumab trial and the BCRG collaboration is the fact that, you know, bevacizumab is just given for a year, just like the CO8 colorectal adjuvant bevacizumab trial. And remember, in CO8, during the first year, the Kaplan-Meier plots are split nicely, And as soon as you stop the bevacizumab, they go back together. And I suspect the Beth trial may look similar.
Yeah, I remember when Norm Wallenberg presented that, that if they had done the analysis at 2.5 years, the trial would have been positive.
Correct.
But it slipped under. And then everybody sort of just pushed it aside. But now that this colon study is starting to come out, and it doesn't necessarily just mean continuation of the same agent. Because,
absolutely,
for example, in colon, you got aflibercept, VEGF trap.
Of course.
Now you got a TKI, regorafenib. I don't know. You know,
yep,
maybe it just means some kind, like HER2,
yep,
some kind of anti-angiogenic longer-term strategy.
I agree. I mean, we have VEGF receptor kinase inhibitors, you know, already in the clinic for other disease states, and those could be applied as a maintenance measure. You know, you wouldn't be restricted to antibodies. But let's say you get a really nice response to bevacizumab chemo induction. Maybe you could switch to maintenance TKI VEGF receptor kinase inhibition as a single agent to maintain the duration of that remission downstream. Who knows?
It's funny. I just got an email from an oncologist saying, I really like your stuff, but I'm sick of hearing about bevacizumab.
Yeah,
and here
I
know. Here I go again.
I thought we were done with it as well.
Well, you know, also we talk about it in, you know, GBMs and ovary and, you know, everything else.